Hey, Matt Teichman here from Elucidations. This is just to let you know that we now have a Twitter feed. Check us out at ElucidationsPod on Twitter. And of course, you can also, as always, check out our blog at Lucian, that's L-U-C-I-A-N, lucian.uchicago.edu/blogs/elucidations. Check it out. Leave us your comments. Thanks. Welcome to Elucidations, a philosophy podcast recorded at the University of Chicago. I'm Matt Teichman, and with me today is Brandon Feitelson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Rutgers University, and Visiting Professor at the Munich Center for Mathematical Philosophy. And he is here to talk with us about paradoxes of consistency. Brandon Feitelson, welcome.
Thanks, Matt. It's great to be back.
So, I think it's pretty intuitive to think that we all want our beliefs to be consistent. You know, I don't want to just say something and then say something that flatly contradicts it later. Otherwise, that makes me a hypocrite. But a lot of philosophers recently have raised some paradoxes that this very intuitive idea raises. So what are some of those paradoxes?
Right. So really, this literature about paradoxes of consistency of belief goes back, well, I would say that Henry Kaiberg's work in the early 60s was very, very formative. He wrote about something called the lottery paradox. Maybe that'd be a good thing to talk about first. We're all familiar with lotteries. There are many tickets. You know, one is chosen at random, that's a winner. And so the probability of any ticket winning, any particular ticket, is extremely low. And you can make it sort of arbitrarily low. Just make the number of tickets as big as you want. And the probability of a given ticket being the winner is really, really low. And we're all familiar with that. So now, consider the proposition, suppose you buy a ticket in the lottery. Now, consider the proposition that your ticket's a loser. Seems quite reasonable for you to believe that. I mean, after all, it's exceedingly improbable that you'll be the winner. So it's extremely probable that you'll be a loser. However, each person who buys a ticket is in roughly a symmetric or a similar epistemic position, of course. And so it seems that for any ticket, it would be reasonable for you to believe of that ticket that it's the loser, right? So just think, now you've got all these individual beliefs. Ticket one's the loser. Ticket two is the loser, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, for each one. And each of those seems fully reasonable because they're all highly probable. But of course, we know there's one winner. So that full set of judgments that I just alluded to, the one which says ticket one's a loser, ticket two's a loser, dot, 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 ticket a billion's a loser, but there's one winner. That's an inconsistent set. Okay, not all those propositions can be true. Okay, so that's what it means for a set of beliefs to be inconsistent, that they can't all be true. But there doesn't seem to really be any problem, at least on the face of it. Each of those beliefs seems reasonable. I mean, after all, you know that one ticket will win, so that belief's fine. And then each of the other beliefs seems reasonable on the grounds that each is very highly probable, overwhelmingly probable. So this was the first kind of example of a case in which you've got an inconsistent set of judgments, but it's not obvious that there's anything unreasonable going on. It seems like each of the judgments is reasonable, and yet as a collective, they can't all be true. So the way I like to think about these cases is that they involve a conflict between two kinds of norms for belief or principles for belief. One principle for belief that's very natural is believe what's true. It's usually called the truth norm or something like that for belief. Believe what's true, very, very reasonable. That seems like a good thing to do. In this case, in the case of the lottery or in other cases that we'll discuss, you know you're violating that maxim somewhere. Right? At least one of your beliefs is false there. Okay. You don't know which, and there's no reason to think for any particular one that it's false. Okay. But there's another principle, there's another maxim for belief that you seem to be acting in accordance with, which is what you might call an evidential norm for belief, which says, believe what's supported by your evidence. And after all, there's certainly a perfectly reasonable sense in which each of those individual beliefs in the lottery case are supported by the evidence you have. So what you've got is a conflict between these two norms. You seem to be in accordance with this evidential norm, believe what's supported by your evidence. But in doing so, it's led to a conflict with the truth norm, believe what's true. That's a really cool thing that Kaiberg kind of discovered. And I think that's really a nice diagnostic way to sort of look at all of these cases, the lottery just being the first one. I actually think later, or around the same time, other similar ones. So the early 60s was a very important time for this. There were other similar paradoxes that came out that I think are even more compelling than the lottery. There are certain avenues of resistance you might try to take. Some people say, well, there's a sense in which your evidence supports that your ticket will lose, but perhaps that's not a strong enough kind of evidential support to really warrant belief. It's because you think, well, it's really just a brute statistical fact, you know, this brute probability, statistical probability. You might think, that's not really sufficient grounds to justify belief. And so people have tried to sort of eke out of this by saying, well, yeah, I mean, there's a sense in which the judgments are supported by your evidence, but really not that strongly. It's just kind of a brute statistical support for the individual beliefs. So there's ways out of the sort of lottery case. But there are other cases where there doesn't seem to be any way out. It really looks like you're stuck in this conflict between truth and evidence, truth and justification. And my favorite one was another one around the early 60s, was discussed by David Makinson first. It's called the Preface Paradox. There are many versions of the preface. Let me just start with the original one due to Makinson. You've written a book. It's a long book. You spent many years on it, painstaking. You've really made every effort to check, you know, all the claims in the book. But in writing the preface, you say something to the following effect, which is not unusual to say in a preface. You say, well, any errors that remain, of course, are not the fault of my collaborators, et cetera, or of my teachers. Or that's on me, right? But that's a little strange to say that in a preface, because it implies that there are some mistakes in there. But wait, I mean, if you stand by each of the individual assertions in the book, but then you've got this claim in the preface that says, probably somewhere I screwed up, that's an inconsistent collection. Again, they can't all be true. Can't be that each claim is true and yet there are some errors. Can't be, right? And if you think about it, though, it's quite reasonable to write a book in this way. It's quite reasonable to say, look, yes, I've checked every claim as best I can against my evidence. Having said that, I'm fallible. It's a very complicated book. This is let's suppose it's a very rich inquiry that involves lots of different aspects. I mean, what are the odds that my evidence didn't mislead me in any of those myriad claims? That would be really surprising in a way. So you think, somewhere I must have screwed up. I mean, it's a huge book and I'm fallible after all. Of course, you don't have any reason to think that any particular claim was a screw up. If you did, you'd retract it. But just sort of stepping back and thinking about psychology and fallibility and the nature of human beings and inquiry, it's overwhelmingly likely I messed up somewhere in such a long investigation. See, it's a similar structure to the lottery, the preface case, except it's harder than the lottery because you can't now say, well, those individual claims in the book, those were just brute statistical evidence. No, this was a scientific inquiry, and let's suppose you had really firm evidence for each of the claims you're asserting, not merely statistical evidence, but real firm scientific evidence for each of the claims. If those aren't justified, then you wonder what in science would be, right? And then you think, what about this second order claim? Look, some of those judgments are false. They're in this book. You might say, well, is that justified? Well, I actually think it is. I think if you look at what we know about psychology and about human beings and about heuristics and biases and some of the very mistakes we talked about on our last podcast, you realize, look, in such a large investigation, it's quite reasonable to believe that some mistakes will be made. You know, either because the evidence is misleading in some subtle way that we haven't realized, or just some simple screw-up. I mean, these things kind of inevitable in a large enough inquiry. And so you don't have this kind of brute statistical response that you had in the lottery. Looks like the evidence for these claims in the book is as solid as scientific evidence is. That's the way scientific books are written. And furthermore, this claim that, look, I probably messed up somewhere along this vast inquiry, that seems to be well supported by psychology and well-confirmed theories of human nature that we sort of know about and believe. Not just for brute statistical reasons, but for what we think are good reasons. So the preface kind of case to me is really the tough case. It really looks like a case where you're following your evidence and not just brute statistical evidence, but really good scientific evidence, and yet you're not obeying the truth norm. That is, somewhere you must have a false claim in here. It can't be that each of the individual claims in the book are true and yet some mistakes were made. Can't be. Something's got to give. But it's not at all a trivial matter to say what's going to give here. And in fact, my favorite discussion of this is David Christensen's book, Putting Logic in Its Place. He has a nice long discussion of this where he considers different kinds of responses in the literature and sort of says, look, I think we're just stuck. This is just a case where acting in accordance with what your evidence supports, believing what your evidence supports, leads to a violation of the truth norm. There's just sort of no way around it. You're going to end up violating the truth norm here, even though you're fully in accord with your evidence.
So in the preface case, the individual claims in the book are the claims that you make because you're trying to follow the evidence. And the general claim that something in there must be false is the claim that is sort of an inevitable truth. We know that as fallible psychological beings, we make mistakes.
Yeah, so absolutely. Absolutely. And you can imagine a book about psychology, or pick any science you like. You know, and so it's a real scientific inquiry. It isn't just brute statistical evidence. It's all the kind of evidence we marshal in favor of scientific claims. And then think about the psychological claim in the background of fallibility and so on, and the tendency to make errors in certain kinds of investigations. This conflict is just bound to happen, right?
And also, I mean, I'm reminded of this view in philosophy of science referred to as fallibilism, the idea that every claim you make in order to, you know, really have substance to it has to be in principle falsifiable by evidence. It would seem that whenever we claim anything, there's sort of this tension between, well, I might be wrong, but I really think I'm right.
Absolutely. And I think this is really par for the course in science. And I don't view it as a problem at all. In fact, I think it's sort of just an integral part of scientific inquiry that it has this conflict between truth and justification. I just think it's built in. Now, what's interesting is to look at the way people have responded to these paradoxes. There's been a tremendous literature since the 60s about this, and there are many different kinds of response to this. I'd like to discuss just two kinds of response and then explain why I don't like either of them. And then what I want to do is sketch out a new way of thinking about coherence of belief, which avoids the paradoxes, but not in an ad hoc way. It just gives you a different way to think about coherence. So let me first talk about the responses to the preface type cases. I'll just talk about, break them into two rough kinds. The first kind is what I'll call the dogmatic response. This is really epitomized by someone like John Pollock, who wrote a series of papers about the preface and the lottery and other similar paradoxes for over many years. And Pollock just sort of puts his foot down and says, no, no, no. Whenever you have an inconsistent set of judgments, it can't be that they're all individually supported by your evidence. He just sort of bangs his fist and insists on that. And in many places, he'll just say, he doesn't really have an argument for that fundamental claim. He just sort of insists on it. And then he works out a very complicated theory of evidential support and undermining and defeat and so on, such that in this theory, which is super complicated, I won't get into it, but I'll just say what happens in this theory is whenever you have an inconsistent set, it sort of generates a defeat, an undermining of the individual support provided for each of the individual claims in the set. There's what he calls collective defeat. This phenomenon of collective defeat occurs. I don't find this at all plausible, and I think most people in epistemology who care about evidence or evidentialists in any way don't find this very plausible, because it just doesn't lead to a very plausible account of evidential support. One of the things that Pollock says, which sort of reveals that this isn't going to be very plausible, is that when this collective defeat happens, somehow the right attitude is to suspend on one or more of these judgments. That is to withhold belief, withhold judgment, to sort of be agnostic on some of the claims. And if you think about the preface, this just doesn't seem like the right move. I mean, after all, I've got as good warrant for the individual claims as I'm going to get as a scientist. That's why I wrote the book. And when you think about the psychological claims about fallibility, especially in certain kinds of inquiries, which we could just focus on those if we wanted, we just need one example. When it comes to that, again, it seems that we have the best kind of scientific evidence we're going to get. Okay? So this idea that we should suspend when we discover an inconsistency just seems unmotivated. It just doesn't seem like the right epistemological response to the situation. David Christensen, as I said, has a very compelling argument for that, and he gives many reasons to reject this kind of Pollock line of just maintaining consistency. So there are other people who argue we should maintain consistency, like Mark Kaplan is someone who is very well known for defending this, and Christensen discusses his view a lot in his book. And Kaplan's view is interesting. Kaplan says he wants to maintain consistency, but he doesn't take this sort of collective defeat line that Pollock takes. He takes a different tack. He says, let's just think about what the aim of science is. He says the aim of scientific inquiry, like if you're writing a book, he thinks, is to paint a complete picture. Ultimately, the ultimate aim of science is to paint a complete and correct picture of what's going on in the world, of the phenomenon. And what he says is, look, if a view is inconsistent, it can't be a complete and correct and perfectly accurate picture of the world. And he thinks that means that you're not achieving your aim as a scientist. Now, that's an interesting view, which I'll return to, and I'll respond to that. But what I will just say quickly is about Kaplan, I wouldn't want to reconstruct scientific inquiry quite that way. What I'd want to say is, it's true that the ideal state of a theory is truth and completeness and perfect accuracy. Of course, that's the ideal state. But it doesn't follow from that that your aim as a scientist is to achieve that very ideal. In fact, I'm going to take a slightly different line, which is kind of what you might call not such a strong realist view, but a more moderate realist view, which is, no, the aim is to get closer to the truth. The aim is to get as close as you can, right? I mean, to make the aim literally to have the complete and perfect theory of the world perfectly accurate just to me seems too ambitious. And I think things like preface reveal why, for human beings, it's just too ambitious a way of reconstructing science. I'll come back to that, okay? So those are the dogmatic guys, the guys who try to defend consistency. And I'll come back to a better diagnosis of why, what goes wrong with that and what I think the alternative is, this sort of moderate realist alternative. Let's switch to the other kind of response. The other kind of response is to abandon consistency, right? So if just at a course level, you either maintain consistency dogmatically or you just give it up. There are two different ways I want to talk about you might give it up. So Christensen gives up consistency for an interesting reason. He says, look, really, when we talk as philosophers about full belief and full disbelief, right, that's a very kind of coarse-grained and kind of primitive way of talking about dogmatic states or epistemic states. He says what we should really be talking about are degrees of belief, numerical degrees of confidence, credences they're sometimes called. And he says for those, there is a coherence requirement, namely that those numbers you assign, how confident you are, you know, I'm 50% confident or 75% confident in something, those numbers should obey the probability calculus. Okay, so the probability calculus is just a set of constraints on these degrees of belief. It doesn't matter the details of what they are. They're just a set of formal constraints. He believes that those are coherence constraints on degree of belief, but he says, that's all we need. We can just do everything with degree of belief in epistemology. We don't really need to talk about beliefs. Those are just really sort of coarse-grained shorthand, if you will, for what's really going on, which is this more precise thing, this degrees of belief. And then he says we can explain everything in epistemology just with degrees of belief. Probabilistic coherence is all we need. We don't need consistency, deductive consistency of full belief, right? And then he points out, well, if we go that way and we sort of abandon full belief, right, we have no problem with prefaces and lotteries. I mean, after all, the lottery was just a case where you assign high probability to a bunch of stuff and also to a claim that says one of those claims is false. That doesn't violate the probability calculus. It's perfectly probabilistically coherent to assign very low probability to each ticket that it'll win, and yet to assign probability one to the claim that some ticket will win. That's perfectly probabilistically coherent. Preface is similar. You can assign very high probability to each claim in your book and also to the claim that some of them are false. It's the same structure. And so he says, look, all we need are degrees of belief and this probabilistic coherence on that. We don't need a coherence requirement for full belief. We can just do away with full belief, sort of explain everything in epistemology using degree of belief. And what he does in his book, which is very ingenious, is he takes lots of traditional epistemological explanations involving belief and shows how to give a proxy explanation in terms of degrees of belief that underlie the full beliefs. That's a really clever project. I actually don't think in the end it can be carried out, but it's a very neat idea. The other way of rejecting consistency that's very popular in the literature now is due to my former colleague at Berkeley, Niko Kolodny. Niko Kolodny argues that Christensen's wrong. We can't do away with full belief. It's essential. We need full belief and disbelief because a lot of our practical and theoretical reasoning really can't be done with degrees of belief. It has to be done with full belief. And I actually agree with him on this, but I won't argue for that here. But what he says is, nonetheless, what we learn from the preface, or at least what we get a hint about from the preface in the lottery is, there just aren't any coherence requirements on full belief. Full belief is a very important epistemological category, and there are norms for it. The only norm he really thinks there is the evidential norm. Follow your evidence. And certainly you're doing that in the preface case and the lottery case. In all those cases, you were following your evidence just fine. The problem was, you were violating the truth norm. Right? So Kolodny just sort of rejects the truth norm and the and that there's any consistency or coherence norm as a result. And so he develops an alternative way of thinking about things that doesn't involve any coherence constraints like consistency. Now, I don't like either of these views. Okay, so I don't like Christensen's view for the same reason Niko doesn't, that he abandons full belief, but I think we absolutely need full belief in epistemology. However, what I like about Christensen is he talks about probabilistic coherence and coherence requirements on credence. I'll come back to that. That's going to be crucial in the new story. Niko, on the other hand, I like his idea that the evidential requirement really has to be respected for full belief, and that's important. Absolutely. I agree with that. But I reject his idea that there aren't coherence requirements. Okay. And so a good way to think about this is this. Both Christensen and Kolodny and other similar philosophers they're implicitly, and for that matter, Pollock and Kaplan, they all accept the following conditional. If there is a coherence requirement for full belief in epistemology, then deductive consistency is one of them. Kaplan and Pollock accept it because they accept both the antecedent and the consequent of that conditional. They think there is a coherence requirement and it's consistency. Christensen and Kolodny, on the other hand, they trivially accept the conditional because they reject the antecedent. They say, look, there's no coherence requirements on full belief. So trivially, if there is, okay, in a trivial sense, if you just think of a material conditional, they accept that material conditional because they think the antecedent's false. So that's a trivial way of accepting a conditional. What I want to say is, the conditional's false. There are coherence requirements, contra Christensen and Kolodny, for full belief. It's just that consistency is the wrong thing, okay? So what I, in my new project, I'm doing with a bunch of collaborators, I should name a few of them, Kenny Eswaran, Fabrizio Cariani, Rachel Briggs, David McCarthy, and some others I've talked to about this, we're investigating a new way of thinking about coherence for judgment, on which, when you apply it to full belief, you get a norm that's just weaker than deductive consistency. It's distinct from consistency. It turns out to be weaker than it in just the right ways so that you respect the evidential requirements. And so what I want to do is just kind of sketch, if I may, the basic idea behind this framework.
So about this idea that, you know, we can't replace the idea that, you know, whenever I claim something, I fully, absolutely believe it with the idea that, well, I kind of mostly believe it. I mean, isn't that kind of intuitive? Isn't it kind of intuitive that, well, you know, there's some chance I might be wrong. And, you know, everybody knows that. So, you know, why can't I just say that when I make a claim, you know, I'm like 90% sure most of the time. And that's good enough for most purposes. What are some problems with, you know, weakening the notion of belief in this way?
Well, of course, absolutely right. I don't mean to suggest that degrees of belief, degrees of confidence are not an integral and essential part of epistemology. I think, of course, they are. I am more of a pluralist, though, in general. And let me just say a little something sort of metaphilosophical about this that might help. Think about an analogous case in the philosophy of mind. Some people would say that certain psychological concepts from folk psychology, like belief or desire and so on, some people, like the Churchlands and so on, would say, well, we should just eliminate all of that folk psychology talk in favor of something, some like maybe neuropsychological, kind of neuroscience type stuff, right, to sort of get rid of it, eliminate it. It's a very similar debate there. People who want to eliminate or reduce things like folk psychological concepts like belief and disbelief down to more, say, neuroscientific concepts. I would reject that move because I'm a pluralist. So I think that as long as a science like psychology, folk psychology, or biology for that matter, or any of the special sciences, as long as the science has a definite explanatory autonomy to it, that is, it offers explanations that really are illuminating in its own vocabulary, I don't think there's any reason to shut down, you know, the biology department or the psychology department or any other special science in favor of, say, physics, because after all, doesn't everything just reduce to physics? Well, in a sense, everything supervenes on the physical, but it doesn't follow from that that we should get rid of our folk explanations. And in fact, I would reject that move. I would want to be a pluralist. Come back to now to the epistemology case. I have the same view. I mean, now we're talking about, if you will, folk epistemological concepts, full belief, full disbelief, and so on. And you might think, let's replace those with these more scientific or more precise numerical ideas, which, for all we know, maybe our beliefs do supervene. Maybe our full beliefs and disbeliefs do supervene on these numerical confidences, just in the way that belief supervenes on the neurological, if the Churchlands are right. But of course, nothing interesting about epistemological explanation follows from, even if you grant the supervenience of full belief on degree of belief. Which, by the way, I don't, but I don't want to get into that metaphysical argument here. That would be taking us too far afield. But suppose supervenience holds. Nothing follows from that. And this is sort of, I think, what Kolodny is on about. When you think about traditional practical reason or theoretical reason and the traditional kinds of epistemological explanations we give of those sorts of, if you will, folk phenomena, it just looks like there's a real explanatory autonomy there, and there really are illuminating explanations that traditional epistemologists give. So I see no reason to shut down traditional epistemology departments. In fact, on the contrary, I think we should encourage as much explanatory plurality and autonomy as we can. So I'm not a reductionist in general. I'm a pluralist. I think as long as there's explanatory autonomy, we should maintain those concepts and use them. And I think certainly the case can be made, I can't make it here, but I think the case can be made for the explanatory autonomy of traditional epistemology, if you want to call it folk epistemology. So I'm very much a pluralist, and so I would want to maintain all those things. I don't see that there's a tendency, right, to want to reduce everything, to want to be reductionist in philosophy, and I understand that impulse. But I would resist that, personally. We could do another thing, another hour later, all on that, on reductionism and metaphilosophy, and I have a whole view about that, but that would be basically sort of the direction of my responses, to even grant supervenience, if you will, and then say, so what? I mean, you know, everything supervenes on the physical. It doesn't mean we're going to shut down the biology department at the University of Chicago. That would be, or the economics department. That would be, I take it, that would be a bad idea.
So the implicit idea that all of these responses you've talked about to paradoxes of consistency have is that they take for granted that consistency means deductive consistency, and you want to develop a new notion of consistency that doesn't have the problems that deductive consistency has.
Exactly.
So what is deductive consistency exactly?
So traditional classical deductive consistency is the idea that if you take a set of judgments, say beliefs, a set of beliefs, in order for them to be consistent, there has to be some possible situation in which they're all true. Okay, so if they logically contradict each other, if they're logically inconsistent, then of course there won't be any possible situation in which they're all true. So in the preface and lottery, that's exactly what happens. It can't be that each of the individual claims in the book are true, and also some of them are false. And so that totality of all of those claims must be deductively inconsistent in the classical sense, because there can't be any situation that makes all of them true. Okay, now I want to do something different. So this is where this project really gets cool. So let's go back to Christensen's idea that really we do have coherence requirements, at least for degrees of belief. Even he thinks that. He just doesn't think we have them for full belief. And let's go back to the beginning of how those probabilistic constraints were justified. Now, there are many justifications for probabilism as a constraint on your degrees of belief. So probabilism just says, when you assign degrees of confidence to propositions, they have to obey the probability calculus. And the probability calculus is a very simple thing. It basically has three axioms. It says you should assign maximal probability to anything that's logically true. So any tautology, for instance, should get a maximal probability, should be maximally confident in those tautologies. You should be minimally confident in contradictions. And usually 1 and 0 are used for the max and min. That's just a convention, but let's just assign them 1 and 0. You should assign confidence 1 or degree of belief 1, maximum to the tautologies, and 0 to the contradictions. And the only other constraint basically is additivity, which means if you have two mutually exclusive propositions, then your degree of confidence in their disjunction is just the sum of your degrees of confidence in each of the disjuncts. And, you know, there's been lots of justifications for these. I won't get into the details of this, but I just want to sort of mention one, which was the inspiration for our new framework for coherence for judgment in general. It goes back to De Finetti in the 70s. Bruno De Finetti was a great Italian subjective probabilist, and he was one of the great probability theorists of the 20th century. He did many great things. One of the really great things he did was give a very interesting novel argument for probabilism as a coherence requirement on these degrees of confidence. And it's a really ingenious argument. And the argument goes like this. First, say what it means for a set of degrees of confidence to be vindicated or to be perfect or ideal, perfectly accurate. And there's a very simple way of doing this. Imagine the omniscient agent. The omniscient agent would, of course, assign maximal credence to all the truths and minimal credence to all the falsehoods. So they'd have 1 assigned to the truths and 0 assigned to the falsehoods. And that's it. That would be it. They're omniscient. So De Finetti says that's the ideal state. Actually, this is a little bit of a gloss in De Finetti. Really, this way of thinking of it in terms of accuracy was done by James Joyce back in 1998. De Finetti gave the formal argument. Joyce is really responsible for this understanding in terms of accuracy. So Joyce says, let's talk about the vindicated or ideal set of credences, and those are the ones that assign maximal value to the truths in a world and minimal to the falsehoods in a world. And then he says, now, just define a notion of distance from the ideal, distance from vindication, let's call it. And the very natural thing to do, which is what De Finetti did, is just use Euclidean distance, because you can think of your all the numbers you assign to all the propositions you think about. That's just a vector of numbers, just a vector. And then the ideal set is just a vector of zeros and ones over the same propositions. Now, just take Euclidean distance between those vectors of numbers. Natural thing to do, right? It's a very natural measure of distance between vectors. And guess what happens? You can prove the following theorem, and the proof is due to De Finetti, but Joyce has generalized it and interpreted it in terms of accuracy and done a lot of additional work. But the very basic idea is just this. Here's a really cool result that De Finetti proved. He proved that the numbers you assign will be non-probabilistic, that is, they'll violate this coherence requirement, if and only if, just in case, there's some alternative set of numbers you could have assigned, which is strictly closer to vindication in every possible world. So guys, let me say that one more time. What De Finetti showed was, if the numbers you assign, these degrees of confidence, violate the probability calculus in any way, That can only happen and will happen exactly when there's an alternative set of credences you could have had, which is strictly closer to vindication, strictly closer to ideal, to perfect accuracy in every possible world, no matter what world you're in. What that means is you're in a position to know a priori that you're not achieving your aim of getting your dogmatic states as close to ideal accuracy as you can. So achieving perfect accuracy would be like achieving the truth norm in its totality, right? That's the analog. But that's not the goal here. The goal is not to get perfect, it's just to get closer. But if there's another guy out there whose degrees of belief are closer in every possible world, then you know there must be a defect, right? You know you're not getting as close to vindication as you could have, no matter what world you're in. It's a really ingenious argument. And what the really cool thing is, this is the work I've been doing with my collaborators now, is generalize. You can generalize the Joyce idea in a vast way. You can basically apply it to any judgments that are accessible in terms of accuracy in a possible world. So take full belief. In fact, that's the easiest and the simplest case, and it's much cleaner even than the credence case. So now, let's take the simplest case, that's all we need for the examples we're talking about anyway, of opinionated belief and disbelief. So let's assume that for every proposition in some set, maybe it's the lottery set, maybe it's the preface set, whatever, just pick your favorite example. For every proposition in that set, you either believe it or disbelieve it, and not both, okay? Where it's assumed that belief and disbelief are incompatible states. So that's an opinionated agent. Now that's a simplification, but just to get things going, just to show you the simplest version of the framework, let's just assume we're talking about an opinionated agent over a finite set of judgments, like a lottery set or a preface set. One of the hard examples is usually what we would have in mind. Anyhow, okay, so they either believe or disbelieve each proposition and not both in some set, and we'll just focus on that set of judgments. Now, we just need to do the three things that Joyce basically did for credences. We need to go through three steps. Step one, say what the vindicated or perfectly accurate set of judgments is involving those propositions. Well, that's easy. It's the one that believes the truths in the world and disbelieves the falsehoods in whatever world you're in, right? It's going to, among this set of propositions, it'll believe those that are true and disbelieve the ones that are false. Obvious, right? I mean, that's the obvious ideal. So we've got our notion of vindication. It's very intuitive and clear. It's similar to what Joyce did. Take the omniscient agent. What would his beliefs and disbeliefs look like over this set? He'd believe the truths and disbelieve the falsehoods, right? In whatever world he was in, okay? So that's easy. That's step one. Step two, we need a measure of distance from vindication. Now, in the case of credence, we had Euclidean distance between these vectors. That was the natural thing. Here, there's also a very natural measure. There are many measures, but I'll just use the simplest one. What you do in a given possible world, if you want to figure out how far you are from being perfect in that world, you just look at what the perfect agent, what the omniscient agent, what their beliefs look like, what their judgments look like, and you just count the number of places you disagree with the omniscient agent. In other words, you just count the number of mistakes you've made in that world, right? So if you believed something that was false, that would count as a mistake. If you disbelieved something that was true in the world that you're in, that would count as a mistake. So all you do is count those. Count all the judgments in that set that are mistaken, right? That are inaccurate. And that gives you a very natural measure of how far you are from perfection. Right? If you've made one mistake, then you're one step from perfection because there's one change you could make that would get you to perfection. If you've made two mistakes, right? So it's a very natural measure. There's many measures you can use, but just to illustrate, I think that's the most naive one, okay? That's the simplest one. And then the third step, which was implicit in the Joyce argument, and I'm going to just adopt the same idea that Definetti and Joyce had. The third step is you need a principle, a decision theoretic or sort of a normative principle that governs that you use this distance measure to ground a coherence requirement with. So in the case of credence, remember, what was that norm? It was, don't be dominated. Don't be such that there's some guy out there whose judgments are always more accurate than yours, no matter what world you're in, okay? Well, let's call that being dominated in accuracy. If there's some other guy that's closer to the truth come what may than you, then you're dominated in accuracy. And so the norm is, don't be dominated, right? Same norm we had before. And that's a very good norm, because if you are dominated, you know you're not achieving your aim of getting as close to the truth as you can, right? So now we've got the full package. We've got our notion of vindication, we've got a measure of distance, which we can then use to define the notion of being dominated in accuracy, and now we've got our norm. The norm is just don't have a set of beliefs and disbeliefs over a given set, which is such that there's some other set of judgments you could have made which is closer to perfection, that is closer to perfect accuracy, come what may. That's the norm. Okay, now the question is, what does that imply? What is the content of that norm for full belief? And here's the really cool thing. I won't get into the details of this. We're writing a big paper, and actually I'm writing a book on this. But here's the really cool thing. you can show, first, that deductive consistency entails coherence in this weaker sense of non-dominance. So now let's call, if you're non-dominated, you're coherent. We'll just use that word instead of consistent. Consistent we'll just reserve for deductive consistency. I'm going to use the word coherent for this new notion. This means you're not dominated in distance from perfection. Okay? Now, turns out consistency entails coherence in our sense, but it's strictly stronger. That is, there are non-dominated sets that are inconsistent deductively. Example, the lottery, the preface. In fact, all of the traditional paradoxes of consistency are cases in which the agent is non-dominated. You can prove there's no set of judgments that dominates them, even though they're deductively inconsistent. So you get a weaker notion, and it's weaker in just the right way. Now, why do I say it's weaker in just the right way? Not just because the preface and the lottery come out coherent. I mean, that's okay, that's nice. But you can say something much more precise than that. And the thing you can prove that we've been able to prove is this. Remember back to consistency. The problem with consistency was it was too strong. And it was too strong in a very specific way. Sure, it follows from the truth norm, the consistency norm, because if all your beliefs are true, actually, then there's a possible situation in which they're all true, namely the actual situation. And so therefore, if you obey the truth norm, you obey the consistency norm. So the consistency norm is very good in terms of truth. It follows from this alethic truth norm. Where it went wrong was it didn't follow from the evidential norm. Remember, we were following our evidence, but we were inconsistent, okay? So what we want, here's what we want, I claim, out of a coherence requirement. We want something that's implied both by the truth norm, both by alethic or accuracy considerations directly, and by evidential considerations. That would be the holy grail of coherence requirements. And in fact, what we want is the strongest such requirement, right? Because of course, many things are entailed by both. I mean, tautologies, right? Take a trivial requirement, that would be entailed by everything. So we want the strongest norm for belief, coherence norm, that's entailed both by the truth norm, by the consistency norm, and also by the evidential norm. So it's gotta be weaker than consistency, but not trivially weaker, just weaker enough to be entailed by the evidential requirements. And guess what you can prove? I won't get into the details of this, but you can prove that our notion of coherence is entailed by what most people accept for evidential requirements. And the reason, the way you can prove that is what can be shown is, so long as the following is a requirement for being in accordance with your evidential requirements, so suppose the following condition holds of you, that you don't believe anything that's improbable, given your evidence, and you don't disbelieve anything that's probable, given your evidence. In other words, you only believe things, say, that have a probability greater than a half, given your evidence, and you only disbelieve things that have probability less than a half, given your evidence. Pretty much everyone in the literature about evidentialism and epistemology accepts that that's a necessary condition for satisfying the evidential requirements. It's not sufficient, of course, I mean, but it's a necessary condition. At least your evidence should probabilify your beliefs and disprobabilify your disbeliefs. That's a very natural, necessary requirement on satisfying your evidential norms. Now, what we can show is coherence follows just from that. Just from the existence of this weak probabilification of your beliefs and disprobabilification of your disbeliefs by your evidence. That's sufficient to entail that you're coherent. And this explains why the lottery and the preface come out coherent. Because, of course, in both of those cases, those beliefs are probabilified by your evidence, at least according to some probability function. Now, maybe in the lottery case, that's just a statistical probability, but surely there's some sense of probabilification given your evidence. And also in the preface, there's a very good, even firmer or thicker sense of probabilification given your evidence. So this is what we've been able to discover. We stumbled into this. We took DeFinetti and Joyce's idea about non-dominance and accuracy. We applied it to full belief, and what came out was this beautiful structure of norms that's entailed both by alethic accuracy considerations, like truth and consistency, and also by your evidential requirements. And now, how does that happen? Well, there's a really nice way to explain how it happens and how this differs from Kaplan and Pollack and the consistency folks. There's a very simple way within this framework to see what they're doing and why we think it's wrong. And this gets back to the stuff about realism as well. So go back to our third step, which was we needed a norm. We chose non-dominance as our norm. Don't be dominated in distance from vindication. But you could have chosen other norms. Here's another norm you could have chosen. You should be such that there's some world at which you're perfectly vindicated. There should be some possible world in which your judgments are exactly accurate. That is, in which you've absolutely nailed the correct picture relative to those judgments. That you can call possible vindication, right? It should be possible for your judgments to be vindicated. Guess what? That's just consistency in this framework. There should be some world in which all the judgments are accurate. That's what basically deductive consistency is. So here's the cool thing about our framework. It's super general. If you want consistency, you just need a different norm. Non-dominance is weaker than possible vindication, right? In just the standard way in decision theory, where if you can't maximize utility in every state, what do? You back off to something weaker, like don't be dominated in utility, something like that. It's a very natural move. So in our framework, we have this very general epistemic decision theoretic framework where we can represent consistency as a requirement. But guess what it requires? This norm that says there should be some possible world in which all of your judgments are perfectly accurate. And remember, I mentioned that's exactly what Kaplan says, that that's the aim of scientific inquiry. It should require at least possible vindication, because the aim is perfect vindication. I say, no. That's too ambitious. I say, perfect vindication would be great. It just can't be had by human beings. And so what I would do is back off to dominance or something like that, because the reason dominance is attractive is, if you are dominated, not only do you know you violate possible vindication, that is, not only do you know you're not consistent, that is, right? And so you haven't gotten everything exactly right. You know something much stronger than that. You know that you're not even getting as close to vindication as you could get, because there's someone who's closer in every world. So I would just back off this really hardcore realist view that we should aim for perfect vindication to a more moderate view that we should aim to get as close to vindication as we can, compatibly with what's possible for us and also with what our evidence supports and so on, these other constraints. That's exactly what dominance gives you. It gives you a norm just like that. So it's a norm that respects consistency, because if you are consistent, then you're coherent in our sense, so that's sufficient. But it also allows some inconsistent states to be coherent, to be rational. Which ones? It turns out exactly the ones that are in accordance with evidence in this weak sense. And so lotteries, prefaces, all the standard kinds of cases come out coherent, but not in an ad hoc way. It's not like we designed the framework to solve the paradoxes. On the contrary, the framework came from thinking about De Finetti and Joyce and how they grounded probabilism. After all, even Christensen thinks probabilism is a coherence constraint. And I say, great, let's see how to justify that in terms of accuracy and distance from vindication and so on. And when you do that, and then you apply the same thing to full belief, you get this beautiful structure of norms which avoids all the classical paradoxes of consistency. It's really an amazing thing. It was really just a coincidence that we stumbled into. We weren't trying to engineer a solution to the preface in the lottery or the other paradoxes. It literally just fell out. And in fact, it's even better than that, because what we've been doing more recently is looking at other paradoxes of consistency in the literature, and there are many. There are tons, not only just individual epistemology, but also in social epistemology and social choice theory and so on. And pretty much in every case where you look out and you see a paradox that implicates consistency, deductive consistency, the classical notion, in an essential way, if you replace consistent with coherent, in our sense, virtually all the paradoxes we've looked at go away. And what this says to me is we're really on to the right way of thinking about coherence. Because the problem with consistency was it was too strong. It was respecting the alethic, but at the expense of evidence. It was respecting truth at the expense of justification. Whereas these new norms we have are exactly sort of at a point of intersection. They're a point of agreement between the truth norm and the evidential norm, between truth and justification. And I think that's what a coherence requirement should be. After all, these should be very weak, rational requirements that everybody kind of accepts, in the sense that if you violate them, everyone should recognize that there's some defect in your epistemic state. The problem with consistency was that wasn't true. Take the preface case. The evidentialist is going to say, there's no defect. You're acting perfectly in accordance with your evidence. Where's the defect? Not so for our notion. Suppose you are dominated. Suppose you are incoherent in our sense, and you're dominated in accuracy. Then even the evidentialist has to admit there's a defect. Why? Because we can prove, since the evidential norm entails our coherence norm, if you violate our coherence norm, there must be some belief you have that's not supported by your evidence, whatever your evidence is. Now, of course, you don't know which one it is, so you're still in this wide scope situation. You don't know there's not necessarily pressure to revise anything, but there's a defect. And that's what was missing with the preface in the lottery. The evidentialists didn't see a defect because there wasn't one from the point of view of justification. Now, if you violate our norms, you're not going to get off so easy. You know both that you've got some false beliefs, of course, because violating our norms entails that you're inconsistent, but also you know that if you violate our norm, some of your beliefs aren't supported by your evidence, no matter what your evidence is. And to me, this is kind of a revolution, because it's an entirely new way of thinking about coherence, not just for belief. Notice, it's the same framework that we applied for degree of belief. So what we've got is a unified way of thinking about coherence for all the different types of judgment. And what comes out of them? Well, in the case of degree of belief, you get probabilism. Very interesting. It's interesting that that's what people had been working with. In the full belief case, you don't get deductive consistency. And lo and behold, there's been so much controversy about consistency since the early 60s. Maybe that's because We just had the wrong notion of coherence in mind from the beginning.
Brandon Feitelson, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks so much.
If you have any questions about this episode, you can post them to our blog at Lucian, that's L-U-C-I-A-N, .uchicago.edu/blogs/elucidations. On the blog, you can get background information on the topics we covered and join in the discussion.